Hello, I'm Kelly Gardner, and you're listening to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to the 27th of October 2019, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations. It's for writers and readers of historical fiction. You'll hear from a huge range of authors: Jackie French, Paula Morris, Anna Campbell, Marie Mankara, Pamela Hart, Ali Elizadeh, Meg Keneally, Kate Forsyth, and many more. The weekend also features academic panels and demonstrations of historical weapons. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to some of our conference guests about writing and reading historical fiction. Like many of our conference guests, Pamela Hart writes in various genres and for different age groups. Her children's books are published under the name Pamela Freeman, and a much-loved name it is too. Her first book of historical fiction, The Black Dress, Mary MacKillop's early years, won the New South Wales History Prize for Young People in 2006. Her other books for children have been shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, the Children's Book Council Book of the Year, Koala Awards, and the Wilderness Society Environment Awards. Her recent series of books for adults, beginning with The Soldier's Wife, are set in the First World War. The latest, Desert Nurse, was released last year. Pamela Hart, welcome to Imagining the Past.
Thank you, Kelly.
In the past few months, you've published a book of non-fiction for kids, Amazing Australian Women.
Yep.
And here you are also writing this series of novels for adults on amazing Australian women affected by the First World War.
Yes, although I am moving away from the First World War. We're in the 20s now for the
people. Excellent. We've...
But the first four, yes, the first four were effectively people who were affected by World War One.
And you've written that The Soldier's Wife was inspired by your grandfather's service at Gallipoli as an Anzac.
That's right, yeah.
So how much are these stories... in this series, drawn from the experiences of real people like him or Louise Mack or the nurses stationed in Egypt?
A significant amount. So that's true of all four books. All four of them are based on something that really happened. Sometimes in The Desert Nurse, I've combined a lot of things that really happened to a number of different people. But there's always a kernel of truth there. There's always, what happens is I research one book and in the middle of researching that I come across this great story and think, oh, I'm going to have to write that, you know. So there's always something that starts me off. And I think that that's why I keep writing them. I keep finding these great stories. That, you know, when I wrote The Soldier's Wife, my grandfather was saved by good nursing. I mean, he was wounded during the retreat quite badly with a lot of shrapnel in him. And after that, he got a fever, as so many of them did. And most people died of the fever rather than of the bullet wound or of dysentery. And he was saved by good nursing in Cairo and Alexandria. And I always knew I wanted to write the story of the women who saved his life, basically. So that story had been waiting for several years to be written. But the others were things that just came up out of research that where I thought, oh, that's too good a story not to tell.
So when you get an idea like that, so you're in the middle of working on something else, how do you capture it so that you don't forget it again? Do you keep an ideas book or some way of tracking all your
books? I have like about 20 notebooks which have 1 to 2 pages written in them and the rest is blank. And I have come finally to accept the fact that I am not a note taker. I am not a notebook kind of person. And to go along with that understanding of myself has come a belief that if the idea is good enough, I will remember it. And if it's not good enough for me to remember, it's probably not a big enough idea to hold up a book.
So it's maybe a post-it rather than a notebook.
Yeah, and maybe it's a short story or something like that. But if I forget an idea, well, then that was not the idea for me.
Okay.
Because the ideas that are for you resonate with you and they stay with you and they come back to you. And if there's, you know, if I wrote every idea I had, there's no way I could write all of them. So you can only write the ideas that are really yours, the ones that hit you hardest, that resonate the most with you. And otherwise, you might as well just forget them. So I don't write them down because the ones that are my ideas, I won't forget. And the ones that I forget are not my ideas.
There you go. Beautiful.
It's a real a post hoc kind of explanation for why I'm too lazy to write stuff down.
But you tried and it didn't work.
I tried it in different ways. I'm just not good at that stuff. Yeah.
Okay, so one of the things I noticed about the nonfiction for kids and this recent series for adults is a lot of them are women's stories.
Sure.
Particularly that Astonishing Generation in the First World War. Was that a conscious choice? And
yes.
What was that about?
Yes. The idea for The Soldier's Wife happened when I went to my son's school for Anzac Day because he was the only one in the class that had a direct link back to Gallipoli. And we have my grandfather's medals and his service record. And we also have copies of the telegrams that were sent to the family when he was wounded. And I read these telegrams out to the class and they were just heartbreaking. The first one says, because he was an orphan, and so his telegram went to his sister. And it said, "Regret report, brother Private Arthur Freeman wounded." And then the next one said, "Regret report, seriously ill." And then the next one said, "dangerously ill."
Oh, no.
And the next one said, "still dangerously ill." And so it was about a month. They got one every 4 to 7 days. And it was about a month afterwards that Esther got the telegram that said, "out of danger." And I just stood there in the class going, what would it be like to be the person who got those telegrams? And that's where the idea of the book came from. And so it was always focused on the people at home because we've heard the stories of Gallipoli are all about the soldiers, always. But the world changed so much in the time they were away. And the thing that's really vivid for me is skirt length. So for thousands of years, respectable women didn't show their ankles. And when the boys went away to Gallipoli, the skirts were decently down on the tops of their shoes. But when they came back, they were halfway up the calf. 1915 was shorter than just about anything until the 20s. And their sisters and their mothers, they're walking around looking like whores, basically looking like prostitutes. And it really struck me when I looked at how much things changed over that 8 months that he was away. What is it like for the people at home? Because they're dealing with that. I mean, the boys go away and then they come back and the world has changed, and that's what war is always like for them. But what about the people at home? How did they cope and how did they adjust and did they realise they were adjusting? And, you know, the focus for me has always been on the home front because of that. And the stories, I just kept finding the stories.
Yeah. Although, and then you've got the latest one, Desert Nurse.
Yes.
You've got a little bit of home front at the beginning, but a woman with very different aspirations to many in her generation.
Well, yes, although increasingly women did have those aspirations. The big issue at that time for Australian women, because obviously for the UK and for the US it was the vote, but we had the vote. We had the vote from 1902. And thanks to South Australia, basically. And
thank you, South Australia.
Yes, thank you, South Australia and Western Australia. But South Australia in particular, Mary Lee and her cohort, they got us the vote earlier than anybody else as New Zealand, you know. But what that meant was that, funnily enough, women's rights kind of took a dive in the public consciousness in Australia in the early 20th century, whereas they were right up there for the rest of the world, or the English-speaking world at least. And women just kind of got on with stuff. And so you have a lot of women going to law school, like they'd been going to medical school since the 19th century, but a lot more women enrolled in university. And this is at a time when Sydney University might have only 120 people going at total at the turn of the century. So women really stood out. But it was all about money. And that was one of the things I really wanted to get across in Desert Nurse. There were a lot of women who wanted to be doctors. There were a lot of women who wanted to be lawyers. But the fees were so huge that there was no way that anybody who didn't come from a very privileged background could even think about it, even if they were male, you know. So there weren't scholarships. Well, they were very, very, very rare.
And you had to live in the city.
You had to live in the city. You had to live in the city. You had to be rich. And you had to have a family that was prepared for you not to earn money for 3 or 4 years, which many families couldn't afford. So that's why I had to make William's father an SP bookie, because I wanted someone from a lower class family to be a doctor, but it was very rare, you know, it was very rare for people to be able to afford it. And so I have a friend whose dad was an SP, and I thought, yep, that's a good way of getting around that particular class issue.
Oh, it's great. And I loved it because I come from a long line of SP bookies.
Oh, do you? How nice. Very good. Well, that story in the book about the lending library, that was a true story. There was a lending library in that spot in Parramatta, and the woman ran the library and her husband was the bookie.
Fantastic. I love those stories of that. Yeah. Such a rich time, isn't it, for those stories of
yes.
Not very distant past.
Mm. A lot of those came from my father's memories, those stories.
Right. So so how do you start then your research process? In that case, you've got actual family stories to draw on, local knowledge to draw on. Mm-hmm. But particularly if you're researching something based on the experiences of real people, where do you begin?
Well, Google.
So do you just Google something and see what happens?
Yeah, pretty much.
Do you have a plan or you just go, oh.
Yeah, no, I'll just see what happens.
Nurses in Egypt.
Well, with that, I had done quite a lot of the research for Soldier's Wife as well. So I was building on material I already had. But, yes, basically I just go looking. I just go looking to see what's out there. And Trove, of course, is the great resource for Australian writers. There's nothing like it anywhere in the world. The National Library database, which is available for free, you know, which is extraordinary. I mean, I subscribe to other newspaper archives elsewhere in the world, and you still don't get the range of material that you get in Trove. Even paying quite hefty fees, you know. So it's an extraordinary resource for writers. And it's always I Google Trove. Those are my two kind of things. And then I buy books. So if there's a limit to the detail that you can get online. So if there's a very, like I have at the moment, for example, quite a lot of books about the early years of radio in Britain, because I needed to write a couple of scenes and film as well. I need to write some scenes for my current book, one set in Savoy House in London during the early BBC years, and some set at L Street Studios in the early years. So when I want to get to the next level, I go to books.
So do you have a research plan? Do you know these are the sorts of things I'm looking for?
Because
you're an experienced researcher.
I'm a very experienced researcher, yes. So that was my job at the ABC, for example, and at the Powerhouse Museum and stuff. So so when you say a research plan, I don't have anything written down.
No, but you have clear questions in your mind? Or?
But I have general questions which I clarify as I go on.
Okay. So it's the clarifying that helps you refine the...
Yes, and it depends how much I know about the story. I mean, some books I know exactly what's going to happen, and that obviously makes the research much easier. Some books you kind of find out what is going to happen as they go on, and at that point you have to stop and do more research, you know. And I'm always researching all the way through to the last draft. There's always something I'll look up. But the big stuff... Well, it took me 18 months to research the book on Mary MacKillop, for example.
Yeah.
And that required both on-the-ground research, going to places that she had lived, you know, and a lot of documentary research, archival research, the Sisters of St. Joseph, reading her letters, visiting orphanages that she used to go to and getting stories off the wall of their little tiny museums, you know. And I didn't feel like I could start to write until I had done most of that research. But then I stumbled across some great stuff about her just before I wrote the final draft. So I wrote 5 different narrative positions in that book, and it wasn't until the 5th one that it all came together. Mm. And I found some stuff that allowed me to do that, that gave me another insight into her quite late in the process. So I don't think you ever stop doing the research until basically the editor pulls it away from you and says, that's enough, Pamela.
But step away.
But the general thing, I know the time. I like to read contemporary books. So if I'm writing in 1923, as I currently am, I will read books published in 1921 and 22.
Fiction.
Or nonfiction. There's a fantastic series of books by H.V. Morton called London at Night, and London Season, which were columns that he wrote for, I think, The Spectator, which are just, I mean, I'm just in love with his writing. He's fantastic. And he has given me so much colour and detail about the world that my characters live in. And because I'm dealing in this book with real people, Noel Coward, Fred Astaire and so on, I'm reading their autobiographies and biographies. And that gives me the world, and then I can write my characters in the world. And then as they do stuff, I need to stop and go, actually, what colour shoes would he have worn? And go find out.
So that stuff, the smaller stuff you do later.
Yeah.
As you need it.
Yeah.
So what do you decide which historical detail to put in and how much to leave out?
It's all about the story. One of the things that we are lucky with as historical writers is that our public, our readership, our audience has an enormous, enormous range of visual images tucked in their head, thanks to the BBC and movies and, you know. And if I say to a readership, she was wearing a dark green sequined flapper dress, the image they have in their head is probably pretty close to mine, because we know what a flapper dress looks like, right? And the reason we know that they know that is because if you go onto Costume Box, and which is like a dress-up place, and you put in flapper dress, that's what comes up, is the fringes, the sequins, the straight, the shoulder straps, that kind of stuff. So what I think is a mistake is to over-describe things that are commonly seen on TV. And the description has to be about evoking a feeling, an idea, a sense of something, rather than painting this really detailed picture for people. Because in the period that I'm writing about, we have photographs. We have photographs, we have films, we have, you know. It's different if you're like Wendy Orr writing about Mycenaean Crete. You know, then you have to do a lot more description, I think, because people don't have that library of images in their head. So for me, the description and the historical detail is all about creating a feeling for the reader that this is a real place. And so the kinds of details I pick are often very domestic detail. You know, the kind of money is quite good, you know, figuring out how much things cost relative to someone's actual income, making it clear that they only have one good dress, because this is something that people don't realise now, that people just didn't have that many clothes, you know, that kind of stuff. Those moments where it's actually really different from the way we live now, but you might not have seen it on a BBC show.
Yeah.
Those are the things that I would highlight.
So what about when you're writing for kids and you can't necessarily assume historical knowledge of certain things?
So I would, there's two things about that. One is that quite often you have pictures. So quite often children's material is illustrated, and your final draft is often taking out description. So you put it in there for the sake of the illustrator, but once the picture is there, you can take it out again. But the other thing is, again, it really depends on the age. You know, like, it really does depend on the age of the child and on the period that you're describing. But they know nothing, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knows nothing. Like, nobody knows stuff. Most readers don't know anything compared to a historical writer. And you just have to assume that they don't know anything. And I remember a friend of mine read the first draft or an early draft of Soldier's Wife and came back to me and said, oh, well, I think you've just put in a bit too much explanation of the war. And then after it came, I went, yeah, I'm not convinced that everybody knows that stuff. And after the book came out, so many people said, oh, I had no idea any of that happened. Oh, it was so interesting, you know. but also we assume that people are Anglo. So, for example, one of my friends who is of Chinese heritage, she didn't know anything about World War One. Why should she? You know, they weren't in World War One. So when we say, oh, but surely people know that, which people are you talking about there? Because our readership in Australia is much more varied than people whose fathers went, your grandfathers went to Gallipoli, you know. So I'm always conscious that we have this kind of bias towards everybody knows that actually means Anglo people know that. And I'm conscious that there are things about the past of Australia that a lot of people won't know because their family wasn't here then.
Yeah. Yeah. And for kids, I remember my first three books were set in the Napoleonic sort of invasion right. of parts of Europe and for 8 to 12-year-olds. And I remember when I first started going to schools after the first one had come out,
I had no idea who Napoleon was.
I don't know who Napoleon was. I mean, so I could correct it in the rest of the series, so that was okay. But it had never occurred to me, actually, that somebody who was 10 didn't know who Napoleon was because I'm just assuming that their brains are the same as mine.
Yes.
But, of course, they're not.
Not only do they – I mean, of course, the thing that immediately – when you said that, I immediately thought of was – but they know who Empoleon is. It's a Pokemon, right? It's this tubby little kind of penguin-like and clearly based on Napoleon, right? There's no question about that. But
yeah, I should have just tweaked that a little bit, shouldn't
yeah,
I?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then it would have been fine.
No, people know nothing. And this is part of why writing history is really important.
Yeah.
Because they'll read a novel where they won't read nonfiction or watch a documentary.
So does that mean the history has to be correct?
I am obsessive about this, yes.
So you don't bend history to meet your story's needs?
No, I don't.
No.
I mean, I might do it in the tiniest of ways, like the weather. Although in Australia, the weather in my books is always the weather on the day because I hate making up weather. And I just go and look at Trove and find out what it was actually that day and use that because it's easier. But I'm, no. No, typically I try to stick as close as possible. I mean, I make stuff up. Obviously, I make stuff up. But if I'm basing something on something that was important to people, like hospitals in World War One, then no, I try to keep as close as possible to the truth. Which doesn't mean I don't take in, like, it's always so fuzzy, isn't it? This current book's a good example. It's called The Charleston Scandal. And in it, my character, who is an actress, is photographed doing the Charleston with the Prince of Wales, and there's a big scandal about it because the Charleston was a black fella's dance, right? It was a dance for Negro people, as would have been said at the time. And there was a big kerfuffle. Now, that's actually based on something that really happened, which was that Edwina Mountbatten, Lord Louis Mountbatten's new wife, was photographed during the Charleston with Fred Astaire. And there was a big scandal. But I have a main character who's female. That's how I would change things, you know. I would shift them for the story. But if that scandal had led to something important, then I wouldn't have changed it.
Right. But you've got the essence. Of
exactly.
This.
Yeah. 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 The idea that, first of all, it was scandalous to dance with an actor, and secondly, that particular dance was very low class because it was associated with black people.
Right. And so you talked earlier about how you, when you're researching, and that sounds like there are lots of sort of complex issues involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about how you use Trove and so on. And I'm just wondering how you capture or what decisions you need to make about capturing that worldview, for example, that racism.
Yep.
That contemporary worldview, whatever it might be. It might be faith in God or
yes.
faith in the country that leads you to volunteer to go
yep.
to Gallipoli.
I think racism is the trickiest one of those in some ways, and the sexism of the male characters. And I think that's in some ways the hardest thing to negotiate. And I'm writing about a relatively recent period, you know. One of my characters, Frank, in The War Bride, I had real difficulty with on that, in that he, I thought of him when I was writing him as a lovely guy, but a man of his time, you know. And his attitude to family, because he was a foundling, he'd never grown up with a family, he was desperate to have one, and so he wanted to push Margaret into being that family, you know. And I had enormous compassion for Frank, and I thought he was a nice guy. But my early readers hated him because they saw him as being trying to control Margaret's life, not listening to her rights, not, you know, as far as he was concerned, they were married and therefore that's how it should be. And, you know, and I really had to come to grips with that, because I was, you know, people giving me this feedback, they're going, no, Frank's lovely, you know, he's lovely. And they're going, no, he's not, he's horrible. And that was a real shock, because I guess I had immersed myself in the time so much that I was judging him by the mores of the day. And by the mores of the day, he was well within his rights.
And it was normal.
It was normal, absolutely normal, the way he was acting. And not bad at all, really. And even looking back on it, I still have, you know, a great deal of compassion for Frank. So I really did have to up his, I had to write more from his point of view so that the reader would understand where he was coming from and why he was doing what he was doing.
Right, so you have to write to the, so that the reader gets to the point of compassion, even though they can't agree with him, but they,
and we don't want them to agree with him, but I did want them to feel sorry for him, because he ends up with nothing at the end. So yeah, so yes, and the way to do that is to go inside their heads, inside that person's head. I think racism though is a much more difficult thing, but I also think that. One of the problems we have with our understanding of history is that we see it as monolithic. And so we go, oh, well, you know, the past was always racist. But if the past was always racist, it wouldn't have been change. So I think it's possible to have characters who may not have completely modern approaches to things, but who like many people of goodwill, stood against what we would consider evils, even if they didn't do anything about it, you know, because there are a lot where there's one person speaking out and protesting, there are 100 people going, yeah, that's right, I'm glad she's saying that, without actually wanting to do it themselves. So I think one of the challenges in historical writing is to show the variety of opinions. If you think about Jane Austen, looking at the differences of opinions about slavery, for example, in her work, I think, you know, you can see that there are very few ideas that went unchallenged all the way through. And so you can choose which of your characters are going to be the ones that challenge those ideas.
But you still have to have those
yes, you do.
Ideas there, present, yeah. Like Frank.
Yes, absolutely, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and often they're the obstacles in my stories, because my stories are mainly about women. Those attitudes are often the obstacles they have to overcome.
So particularly thinking about those more recent World War I and the 20s, you have access to those people's thoughts through letters or diaries. Yes. And do their voices come through in that, and do you try and replicate those voices?
Certainly you have access, particularly in World War I. We're very lucky that the War Memorial has collected and digitised a huge number of diaries from World War I. And we're lucky in that, because Gallipoli was recognised almost instantly as a truly significant moment in Australian history, families kept all the letters. They kept the letters and they kept the diaries. And so we have access to a very wide range, not just from soldiers, but from medical orderlies and nurses and doctors. And absolutely, that was one of my first places to go for Desert Nurse, was to go and read all of those. And you certainly pick up on turns of phrases and the language that was used, particularly in letters. Letters are often very chatty. You know, if they're between friends or siblings, the letters between siblings are great because they're the most relaxed.
Right, not like writing to your parents.
Exactly, yeah. But you also have to be wary of the content. They're great for tone and vocabulary and sentence structure, but the content you have to be very wary of because people lied in them all the time. So the men in particular lied about the conditions they were in. And that was because they wanted to protect the people at home. And the only ones that where you really get a sense of what it was like is the diaries, certainly, but the letters, there are a couple of letters where men are writing to their fathers and those fathers had been in the Boer War. And then they write from one soldier to another and you get a much more accurate glimpse into their daily lives. But if you relied on the letters to their mothers and their sisters and their sweethearts and their wives, you would think they were having just a jolly time, a jolly time. So, you have to be careful about content in those kinds of things.
Yes, I heard Janet Butler, who edited Kitty McNaughton's diaries, I think was the name, Kitty's War was called.
Right.
Talking about how before the First World War, people who went overseas, and of course most Australians never did, if anybody did, they kept a diary for the purpose of reading it together when they got back.
Yes.
It was not
so
a personal thing.
It's very curated.
Very curated. And so the outgoing diaries on ship are all like as you're describing. And once they get there and once, especially with the nurses, once the first waves of wounded, of casualties come through, they can't do that anymore. And so the whole idea of diary keeping
changed.
In that historical moment. Same on the Western Front, same with all those amazing memoirs that we got.
And when they came home, and there were people who sent sections of diaries home kind of month by month, but most of them, as you say, they turn into what we think of as a diary and being a personal thing. And very often they just pretended they didn't have time to write one. There are exchanges of letters where someone says, oh, and don't forget to send us your diary. And the next is a quick note going, oh, I'm sorry, we're just too busy for me to keep the diary, but I'll try to keep you updated in letters. And you can just go, sure. Because they were too busy, apart from anything else. It was particularly during the Gallipoli campaign, it was a continuous onslaught. But how do you write to your nice, loving family that, you're dealing with, for example, a young man who has to be fed by tube because his cheek has been blown away and if he puts food in it, in his mouth, it falls out. Those kinds of things were actually more distressing than, say, amputations, which were at least clean and done. But the facial injuries were really horrific and very hard. And, that's where plastic surgery comes from, is from people trying to fix that stuff.
Are you planning more books in that series?
Is this in the Pamela Hearts thing?
After Desert Nurse. So is the 1950s one right?
Well, yes.
Is it a series as we understand a series? Because they're not.
They're not. They have crossover characters. I think of them as a universe. I come out of science fiction and fantasy writing, and quite often there you'll have writers who write in a universe. Ursula Le Guin is a good example, her Haynish universe. And so all of her science fiction novels happen in the same universe and they have some crossover characters. But each book is standalone, and that's kind of the approach that I'm taking. This 1923 book is quite different. There are no crossover characters. We get a brief glimpse of one of them, but basically this is a whole new cast, and it's in England. So, we do have two. My actress gets interviewed by the main character in A Letter from Italy at one point, but that's about all that happens. There's no real, so it's the same, it is the same universe, but there's very little connection. But there is another book I do want to write eventually about two of the characters from The War Bride, but it's a long way down the track. I have a lot of books in between. The one I've talked to Hachette about after this is actually a dual timeline World War II story, so contemporary plus World War II. So interestingly, some of my readers have christened these books the Anzac series.
Right.
Which I quite like.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I did kind of have had enough of World War One for a while.
All right, so you can move on to World War Two, and it can still be the Anzac series.
I guess it could be, although it's not really, because it's not any, in this book doesn't have any Australian characters.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so.
I just wanted to ask you one last thing, and sure. That is, what do you enjoy about being a writer?
Not going to work every day, not commuting. I know that's a facile answer, I'm sorry.
Not that it's not work.
No, but it's the commuting that I like not having. You know, working from home I do love so much. I haven't had a proper job since 1989.
Wow. So you just commute from kitchen to office?
Yeah. So before I had a baby almost 18 years ago, I was a consultant in organizational communication as well as a writer. And then I became a mum and a writer. And I teach, obviously I teach creative writing at the Australian Writers' Centre. I don't know whether I like writing or not, but I know that I hate not writing. So Stephen says, my husband, he says that I get cross and cranky and not very nice to live with when I'm not writing. So I suspect it's an addiction.
But are you saying you don't particularly enjoy it?
Look, there are days when it's fantastic, when it's like flying, you know, and there are days when it's like slogging through mud. And it's like any job that you have a feeling for, that you a vocation. There's a lot in it that's wonderful and brilliant, and I'd rather do it than anything else. And there are days where you're doing your eighth draft and you're sure that this story is the absolute least original story ever written by anybody, when it's really hard. And you just have to learn that that's part of the process, and you always feel like that at the eighth draft, and, you know, that's why you have readers and beta readers and editors to go, no, it's fine, you know, and you learn to trust them. But I don't want to give the impression that it's unalloyed joy, because then nobody finishes their novel, right? I mean, I'm thinking here about my students. They think it should, if you're inspired, it should be easy, and it's not easy. And if you go into the process thinking, I am just going to love being a writer all the time, you probably will never finish a book. So that's why I wanted to say, well, yes, it is fantastic. It is great because you get to play. It's basically play all day. You play making up stuff just like you did when you're five. And in that sense, it's, you know, it's the best job in the world. But it's not always easy. And I think it's really important that people know that it's not always easy, because otherwise they give up when it gets hard and then they never finish. And the number one reason your book won't be published is that you haven't written it.
Is that your main tip for emerging writers?
It is my main tip for emerging writers.
Finish
the damn thing. Just write the book, and don't expect it to be always fun, but it will be great once you've done it, you know. Writing is not always great, but having written is fantastic. My tips for emerging writers is, one, just write it and don't go back to try and fix it, because you can't fix the beginning until you've written the end. And the other is, you always need to do lots of drafts, because I ask publishers all the time, what is your main problem with the manuscripts that you get? Because I teach, so, you know, I want that information for my students. And over and over and over again, they say, they're not cooked enough. They haven't had enough drafts. They haven't been let to sit for a while, so that the writer's objective when they come back to it, that we just get them too early. So that would be my second advice.
Great advice.
Yeah.
Great advice. Thank you very much, and thank you for talking to me today. And we look forward to seeing you at the conference in October.
I'm just looking forward to that. It's going to be a hoot.
It will be a hoot. We get to do nothing but talk about historical fiction the whole
time. Yay!
Geek out. So thank you very much.
Historical fiction writers are really very nice people on the whole.
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good gang.
Yeah, it is. Thank you so much, Kelly.
Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a showcase of some of the writers in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to 27th of October, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations for writers and readers. You can find the 2019 conference program, book tickets and listen to more episodes of Imagining the Past at hnsa.org.au.